Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Everyone awake and ready?
Good.
Will you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Beautiful, powerful vibration that creates. Raul Becerra wrote an email from Anandashram. Hari Om, Pujya Swamiji is stable. He has given darshan through an open window twice this week. Haridas has a fever now, and I'm just now getting over it. Pramanad left Wednesday morning with a voice. What a voice. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And I should have read this one first. It came first. Hari Om to all. I shortened my stay at Ramana Ashram. It was a blessing. God arranges all things for the best. When I arrived at Anandashram, Papa's grandson, Pram, was at the ashram. And on Sunday, he performed several beautiful songs. On Tuesday, 22nd of January, he sang three different versions of Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram at the Bhajan Hall, Ram Nam Chorus, for 1 hour. The voice of an angel brought tears to these eyes. I couldn't stop the tears until he stopped singing. What a blessing this was. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Raul. It's inevitable that when somebody comes or writes from the ashram that they bring some of that spirit with them. Reading from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Royal Science of God Realization, begins with a quote from the Gita, and this is Krishna showing Arjuna the universal vision. It is some of the most powerful verses within the Gita, and the Gita is some of the most powerful verses ever written. What a text we have within the Bhagavad Gita. The ostensible reason for the writing of the Gita was a description of a conversation that was going on between Arjuna as the disciple and Krishna as the guru, the one who has come to bring the disciple from the darkness into the light. It is a universal message. It is not just circumscribed to a particular time and space, but it is for all humanity and the upliftment of everyone who hears these verses. Arjuna, as the story goes, is on a battlefield. It's just before the battle is to begin. He has doubts. And it's tough stuff, you might say, in a way, because what Arjuna is facing is the terrible aspect of creation. War, suffering, difficulties, having to show courage, in the face of what are times overwhelming odds, sticking to the truth of what you know. And the truth is, Arjuna wants to leave the battlefield. He wants to quit the battle. And it is all a description of what happens inwardly to all of us upon the path. We face many obstacles in life. We face the obstacle of our own internal turning away. We're lazy by nature. We don't want to have to do the hard work that it takes to get to realization. That's the truth. We all have that nature in us. We don't want to have to face the derision of friends and family and other people in society who may find fault with us for seeking out the path of realization. That is a reality, a social phobia, a fear of what others will think of their judgment. And really, it is a reflection of our own judgment of our own selves, because everything that we see in the outer sense is reflected, is a reflection of the inner. And so we turn away from the light and we turn toward the darkness. And it's not always obvious. We do it in subtle ways. We do it in ways that we cut short our true aspiration. I have said before, and I think that it is very true, that when you look at the lives of the great spiritual masters, personalities greatly vary. How they express themselves, their specific approach to God, is all different. What is the same is a clarity of vision that they have for themselves, that God within them and the realization of God is more important than the things of the world. They recognize that there are challenges along the way, and they're willing to embark upon the journey in spite of the challenges. They don't turn away from the light and turn toward the darkness. But where we find Arjuna at is he's in that precise condition. And Krishna, as the guru, both in the outer sense and the inner sense, is awakening Arjuna to the light. And through the course of this conversation, Krishna reveals his universal nature. Now, in the universal nature, he sees that all creation is a manifestation of the one divine life. And sometimes that creation shows a lovely face, such as through nature, a sunrise or a sunset, through beautiful stands of forests, the ocean, people living in harmony, serving one another, and also shows the terrible face of God. The face of God where death is a reality, old age, disease, violence, it's all part of the package. And we can well reason within ourselves, how could God, who is all loving, all blissful, all wise, be a part of anything that is a terrible aspect? And the truth is, we can't really know and resolve this issue until we ourselves have entered into a state of realization. Had a very interesting conversation with Larry's son-in-law, Jordan, as we were celebrating the birth, the coming birth of their child. And he was talking about the role of genetics that he's studying in a PhD program right now, of DNA, RNA, all the interactions that go on in this tiny little world that has such great importance to all of us. And we are discussing where the intelligence comes from, the designer of the design, if you would accept such a notion. Does the design imply that there is a designer? When you're focused on the mechanics of a certain thing, you don't necessarily think about the designer and everything that's gone on into the creation of that. You're just simply trying to solve a riddle. It could be comparable to somebody who's looking to repair their automobile, and they need a certain part. And what they're really focused on is what's wrong with the automobile, how do you fix it, and how do you get the part and install it. They're not really thinking about the designers, about the engineers, about those who went into the manufacturing of the automobile itself. That's not necessary for them to accomplish their task, which is to fix the car. And yet, without all of that design, all of the engineering, all of the thought that went into the design of that car, the car would never exist. But you see, you can cut that off. You don't have to focus on the designer in order to work with the designed product. And yet, how much richness it adds to the whole project when you understand the great minds that went into designing this product in the first place. How much more awe, how much more appreciation, how much more beauty it adds. It's just a fact that when you focus upon the Creator, God, into the creation, it adds value to the entire creation. You can live your entire life without really giving a second thought to the Creator. But what you don't get is that additional awe and joy and wonder that comes about by focusing your mind upon the Creator itself. There are some things that are systemic to a spiritual life that does not occur within a spiritual life. You don't need a God in order to behave well. But how much more it adds to your life, and how much more it attunes yourself to good behavior when you do focus upon God alone. Not because He is someone who is going to smite you or smote you if you misbehave, but because you want to. As a child, you may have curbed your misbehavior because you were afraid of the consequences. But as soon as the parent is out of the picture, then you don't feel any restraint for good behavior. But if you love your parent and you want to please them and you want them to be proud of you, then whether they're in the room or not makes little difference to you, because you know that if word gets back to them about any misbehavior you may have, you would feel crushed that they would be disappointed in you. So how much more stronger is love than fear? And when we enter into a loving relationship with the Infinite Father, who is the Creator of everything that is, then we want to please Him, not out of fear, but out of love. And this makes a great, great difference. Anyway, back to our discussion of Arjuna. And we find here that Krishna is talking to Arjuna after the universal vision has been revealed to him. The Blessed Lord then said, "In the guise of endless doom, I come as avaricious time to seize and room in burning maw of mine the weakling's awe. And all the mortal meat of weary worlds of deathly change and treat them with my nectar life to new and fearless better strife. Even if thou dost forbear to slay thy wicked foes, still they and the warriors all in brave array will sure and certain timely have to fall. Ah, in my righteous teeth of law with all. Arise, awake, arise, awake! Dash thou upon the foe, the flesh of captive make, and win the victor's fame with battle-hunted gain, wealth of the king, of peace, and heaven's kingdoms bring. I know right now the happenings all, that mystic future forth doth call. And thus thy foes and warriors true, long, long ago I slew. Ere shalt thou, agent hand, that I would wield to land, thy foes on death's dim shore, now understand. My agent thou, ah, this is how I work my plans the universe, through instruments diverse. 'Tis I who slew, and yet will slay the senses' train. Through thee, as through both past and future ones, my soldiers sing. And from Master. These verses from the Bhagavad Gita are an unparalleled ode to the universal form of spirit, a paean to the glory of the cosmic bodied dream idol enshrined in the wall-less temple of infinity. Massive universes and their tiniest particles, majestic gods of nature and the most insignificant of creatures, the shadow plays of good and evil, all hold their special place in the confirmation of the cosmic image. Often are these verses sung in worship in India. When properly intoned in the original Sanskrit, the vibratory blessing awakens a thrill of knowing in the receptive devotee, stirring sleeping memories of truth realization, held sacredly safe in the inner sanctum of the soul. I've experienced not just through the Gita, but through other Sanskrit intonations. And I was at Ramana Ashram, and the voice of the priests and the young boys who were singing, the priests in training, the power that was generated through the intonation of Sanskrit. Sanskrit was a scientifically designed language that has intonations of every part of the human voice. And each vibration, each intonation, carries with it a vibration that represents a state of consciousness. And that this beautiful language, when it is sang properly, awakens real divine power within you. And so I can testify from having heard it myself what power there is in that. Through the portals of this song of praise, off I've entered into the cosmic temple to worship at the altar of the manifested Lord. Many years ago, after one such experience in cosmic consciousness, I wrote the Vision of Visions, a lyrical rendition of these verses interwoven with an interpretation of their significance. I offered this rendering herewith, rather than a more constrained verse-by-verse literal translation, in the conviction that the unique animation of feelings characteristic of poesy is a proper medium for the eloquence of this Sanskrit scriptural canticle. Spirit, the blissful consciousness of the unmanifested absolute, inconceivable to the circumscribed minds, spins within an infinitesimal part of its cosmic consciousness, a universal form, a dream of being. Each component of universal creation is individualized cosmic consciousness, unified with all other manifestations by the bonds of nature and cosmic law. God is the supreme dreamer of nature, and God, as the individualized, delimited intelligence subject to nature. From gods to men, together create all happenings in the universal drama through the operation of cosmic law. The human consciousness is perplexed and unable to reconcile the benign and destructive aspects of the Lord, bestowing good and beauty to man and the world on the one hand, and bringing death and destruction on the other. But if spirit be omnipresent and the essence of all, naught can be outside of him. Thus does God declare in the Bible also, from Isaiah, I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God besides me. I girded thee, invested thee with thy powers and attributes. Though thou hast not known me, I am the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Isn't that a stunning admission? I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. The duality of good and evil, joy and sorrow, life and death, are meant neither to hurt nor please anybody, but to afford infinite opportunities to the Lord's children to experience the cosmic dream, and by right participation, to evolve to higher and higher states of wisdom and freedom. The Lord is the sole reality. The cosmic drama is His dream. The value of all dualities is relative to their end result. The hue and cry of mortals is because their consciousness is short-sighted, forgetful of causes, and ignorant of the ultimate consummation. This is wonderful. The hue and cry of mortals is because their consciousness is short-sighted, forgetful of causes, and ignorant of ultimate consummation. It is because of our limited view of this world that we get caught up in the, you might say, the details of life, and we forget the big picture. The cause, the ultimate cause, is the infinite Lord of creation. It is through this cause that everything has come into being. When we look at the creation and all the ways that it has come about, we look at the nature of DNA, RNA, we look at how things tend to come and coalesce into organisms, whether it is on a biological or a social level, or on the realm of physics and how planets and suns come into being. It is amazing and awe-inspiring creation that we live in. It is all indicative of a tremendous creative intelligence and consciousness and power that has brought everything into being. We are told by the great mystics and saints down through all time that this world and all creation is reverberating with a vibration of bliss, of light, of intelligence that is beyond human conception and the human mind. But who has realized it? When we enter into this creation and we forget the causal factor of what brought everything into being, then we do get caught up in the details of life, and we can get focused on the darkness instead of the light. In fact, we become repelled to the light, such a state of consciousness we can enter into. And as a result of the focus on what's evil or what is wrong or what is dark in our lives or in the world, we begin to enter more fully. It is as if our thoughts are like the navigation system. And when our thoughts are steered in a certain direction, the rest of us follows. And we go down deep into a well of darkness that really is a dead end. We go further and further and explore it and explore it. And as we get fascinated with it and get more concentrated on it, we enter more deeply into it until we finally come to the point that we realize this has nothing, nothing to offer us. It is only by turning toward the light, it is only by transcending the duality of the human mind and of creation that we can attain to anything greater. There seems to be some grace inside of us that begins to awaken that knowledge within us. But like Arjuna upon the battlefield, we still have a tendency, or at least the temptation comes to us, to turn away from the light. And when we do, we, like Arjuna, take on a despondency, a depression, a feeling of being weighed down by all the darkness, unknowingly to ourselves oftentimes. By turning toward the darkness, it weighs down on us with greater pressure. Now, if there were no resolution to this, if there were no way out, we would say this is truly hell. And when we're in the middle of this kind of consciousness, we are in hell, and we feel that we are, because we don't see a way out. A part of the mind may believe that there is something greater, something of light. We want to believe in it. But when we're in that state very fully, we don't see it at all. We don't really feel it. And so we exist in that darkness. Now those who stay in the darkness and don't turn toward the light at all tend to dwell there and stay there for as long as is necessary until finally the consciousness begins to turn towards Krishna. That is the light of being, the light of the Guru's teachings, the light of the eternal Dharma, the light of the eternal soul within the individual. We have to turn away from the darkness. It's almost as if breaking our vision if we're looking at some terrible accident or something, a fire that's going on, something like that, that's compelling our vision to keep our vision on it, even though it's a terrible situation. People are suffering. People slow down to see a car accident, to see perhaps there's some terrible injuries or blood that's going on. And what is it inside of us? There's something inside that compels us to focus on the darkness. Today, if we listen to the news very much, and it's 24/7 on television and radio and other places, we can get compelled into looking at the darkness and the terribleness of life. Now, in that state of mind, we don't see God in creation. We don't have that universal vision. And so that begins to weigh us down, depress us, and make us feel very bad about ourselves, feel very hopeless. And even though our outer situation may not be all that bad, inwardly we feel we are caught in a hell. When we really turn our mind toward God, when we really turn away from the darkness, with everything inside of us, we ask God to help us, to lift us out of this darkish hell that we found ourselves in and turn our minds towards the light. That is the beginning. Now, it doesn't automatically follow that everything will be resolved and be just so. It is a struggle, not because God is withholding himself from us. Grace is always coming towards us, but we ourselves have built a wall against the individual soul and the universal light of consciousness that is surrounding us. It is a struggle. We have to work hard at it. We have to be mindful and watchful of where our tendency takes us. There's a part of us that wants to withdraw back into the darkness. We have to strive to go for that light again and again and again. We have to make that battle with all the clarity that all the great masters ever had. When the Buddha came to the point that he was willing to put aside everything of the world in order to know the truth, in order to realize that great transcendent state of being, it wasn't until then that the universal vision was granted to him. And so with Mother, with Master, with Papa, a turning away from this world, a turning away from the darkness, our own internal darkness, and turning toward the light is a must. We cannot tolerate within ourselves any adherence to the darkness whatsoever. This great clarity of mind really puts us into the way of our sadhana. In the beginning, we may take up the practice a little bit here and a little bit there. It must come to us as powerfully as the breath that we draw. The disciple who asked the master, "What does it take in order for me to get God realization?" The master said, "Follow me." He took him down to the river. He put the disciple's head under the water. The disciple thought, "Well, this is a little bit of a strange thing to do." And then he began to run out of air, and he struggled. But the master didn't let his head up. He kept him under the water. Pretty soon he was fighting for his life. He was clawing, he was scratching, he was doing anything that he could at all to bring himself up. And now he felt himself passing into unconsciousness. Now at last the master brought his head back up, and he gasped for air. And he laid on the side of the riverbank until he finally recovered. At first he is angry with the master for doing this thing, but then he thought there must be some reason for it. And at last his mind calmed down to the point where he could take in the teaching. And the master said this. He said, when you want God just as desperately as you just wanted some air when your head was underwater, then you shall have him. What clarity of mind, what determination, what purpose comes to us. But you see, we dilly-dally along. And we do a little bit here and we do a little bit there, but we're always bargaining, aren't we? Mother had the wonderful story of the pearl of great price, where the final asking price was the only one that was accepted. No bargaining. But don't we want to bargain? Well, God, I would like to have God realization, but you know, I'd also like to have a comfortable life. So I'd like to have a nice couch, and I'd like to have a nice home, and I'd like to have a nice comfortable bank account. When I have all of these things, and maybe a little bit more, well, just a little bit more, and always a little bit more, then I'd be really happy to have God realization too. Wouldn't you mind giving me all these things? And then I'll be very happy and satisfied, and then I'll want you, and I'll accept you. But who does it? How many people think, well, I just, you know, I'm so busy with life, when I get to retirement, then I'll really focus in on God. But you know what? When retirement comes, you wonder how you ever had time to work. So then you're off and you're busy and you're doing this and that and the other thing. And oh, by the way, that extra long meditation, it never quite gets around to that. Because there's everything that seems out there to be so enticing. There's never a better time than here and now. This is the time and place. There is no other, really. If you don't cultivate the habit now, you won't somehow automatically have it later on. Vairi Mahasaya said, cultivate the awareness of God in the springtime of your life so that in the fall time he'll be in full residence. There is no such thing as getting something for nothing. We have to be willing to do the work. We have to be willing to set aside the time. We have to be willing to invest ourselves in our own spiritual journey. There is so much of the world that is looking for some savior to come from out of the clouds of heaven or to be born upon earth or maybe some calamity that come along that will wake everybody up, that will make everyone realize, that will punish the evildoers and reward the good ones. And of course, each one of the person thinks that they're the good ones and the other guys are the bad guys. It doesn't work that way. Awakening happens because people make individual efforts. They awaken to the need that they need to act well. Not because there is some mean-spirited God who's going to punish them, but because they see the necessity of it, they see the goodness of it, the wholesomeness of it, they see the rightness of it, and that truth begins to determine their actions. This is the only way. Catastrophes will not automatically awaken mankind. Look at what happens when things of the society and our infrastructure begin to break down. Many times people turn into thieves who ordinarily would not be so. Greed and fear run rampant. It is not a recipe for realization. Only the awakening of God within each and every individual. And it is not that when people get prosperity that they automatically turn towards God. Look at the number of people who have great prosperity by worldly standards, and yet they've never been in bigger debt. They suffer with great anxiety. There is no guarantee that having more wealth will guarantee peace or happiness. It doesn't come in this way. But how long it takes for us to finally get it, not just intellectually, but down in our bodies, down in our emotions, down in our bodies, through every cell of our being. It takes a radical shift of nature to shift our attention from the world to God. It doesn't come in a day. It doesn't come without effort. And it is also does not come without God's grace. It is not just up to you, the individual, But when you love God, that is desire realization, desire truth, with all of your heart, with all of your mind, with all of your strength, and with all of your soul, then you will really put your feet upon the path. And not until then. Until then, you're just playing with it. You're bargaining. You're saying, all right, I'll seek you as long as I have these other things taken care of. And it's putting the cart before the horse. Put God first. And accept whatever He gives to you as for your highest good. And when you can really do this, you will feel peace of mind. Not everyone is called to a life of poverty. God wants for your highest good. Poverty does not guarantee God realization, otherwise all the poor people in the world would be God realized. There is no outer secret ingredient. There is only the inner awakening that comes with realization. So back to Master's commentary. The Lord is the sole reality. The cosmic drama is His dream. The value of all dualities is relative to their end result. The hue and cry of mortals is because their consciousness is short-sighted, forgetful of causes, and ignorant of the ultimate consummation. Arjuna's vision represents the operation of the great cosmic law as seen, not from the point of view of creatures, but from that of the Lord Himself. His design is beyond finite questioning and justification. To the Lord, the destruction of life is not an absence of benignity, nor the giving of life a presence of it. The reality is that life and death and all experiences enveloped therein are mere forms of change, varying according to His cosmic law and leading the cosmos with all of its individuals to progressively loftier stages of unfoldment. Every human being is expected to do his duty with non-attachment and with the consciousness that he is not a hapless victim, but an intelligent agent of the infinite being. Man begins to reestablish his innate divine nature first, by perceiving and honoring the Creator in the goodness, beauty, and harmony in his environs. As his understanding penetrates deeper into the core of all manifestations, he recognizes an inexplicable something as their source and essence. Having glimpsed the heart of reality, he attains the summum bonum of truth, that God is all. Even the contrasts that seemingly do not declare Him, just as no image in a dream, neither the beautiful nor the nightmarish, may be dissociated from the dreamer. Still, such an inclusive concept defies even the expanded scope of devotee's understanding. Like Arjuna, he hears the words that portray the Omnific One. But without the experience of cosmic consciousness to which he may relate them, they lack reality. And this is a wonderful thing. No matter how much we study the scriptures, no matter how much we give in the way of service or tithing, there is nothing in this world that will give us realization other than realization itself. This may seem like a self-evident statement, but how often we try to settle for something less than complete realization. You know, being on this path is not accepting a certain set of ideas because I have said them, or because Master or Mother have said them. It is the awakening of that truth within yourself. And that awakening goes through different levels of experience. At first, it is an awakening of the mind and attitude. But then it awakens an experience so deep within your soul that your entire being sings out with the beauty, the light, and the love of that tremendous experience. Now your entire soul is lit up with that beautiful, wonderful spirit. It is no longer a projected idea, a theory, something that you believe that is true. Rather, it has translated itself into a bona fide, true experience of which you are now founded upon unshakable ground, a divine realization. This is the end of all creation. This is the consummation. This is where everything is headed for. And when you step into that realization, and sometimes it is for but a brief moment, but gradually, as you purify the mind, it becomes a continuous experience and so grounded in your being that nothing can shake you from it. It is from this perspective that Papa writes on divine love, "The greatest acquisition of human life is divine love. Divine love is the love for the Lord, seated in the hearts of all beings and creatures. This love is attained by the devotee in the first place only through the realization of the Lord in his own heart. The Lord is the master of the worlds. He pervades the entire universe. He is the supreme ruler of all the planes and spheres of existence. Since he is everywhere and all, to behold him in all beings and love them all is the true adoration of the Lord. In this vision of love, the apparent good and evil have no significance. This love is based upon equality and a consciousness of universality. Divine love is absolutely pure and crystalline. It does not see distinctions and has no likes and dislikes. It flows from the heart of the devotee and floods the world, embracing and absorbing all alike, just as the light from the sun shines equally on all. It sheds its sweetness on all to the same degree. The devotee who has realized this exalted love is spontaneously blissful in all his activities, since these are permeated through and through with love. The real joy of the eternal is conceived in the womb of divine love. Divine love expresses itself in cheerfulness, contentment, self-sacrifice, forgiveness, compassion, and peace. This love is absent in the heart in which, in the place of the Supreme Lord, ego has installed himself. The ego is the cause of the soul's bondage and misery. The moment the soul realizes his supreme and divine nature by union with the Lord in his heart, he becomes the very lustrous moon emitting always soft and soothing rays of divine love. The ego obstructs the free flow of divine love in the human being. So to earn the supreme blessings of this glorious love, a one-pointed devotion to and adoration of the Lord of the universe is the way, the means, and also the goal. Adoration of the Lord signifies a loving remembrance of him at all times, and this remembrance can be most easily effected by taking constantly the Lord's divine name." And what happens when this realization so pervades your entire being that it guides and directs every particle of your being? I've been reading a wonderful book, A Goddess Among Us, The Divine Life of Nanda Moyima. It was sent to me by a Swami Mangalananda, a Westerner, whom I met when I was at Anandashram. He sent me this book that he wrote, and it is beautifully written. Get the information to you all so that maybe we'll do a mass ordering of it, because I think it's wonderful. And this is The Wandering Pilgrims. Anande Moy Ma, called Ma. Ma continued on her travels, prompted by the heartfelt call of her devotees. For several months, she traveled completely incognito with just one companion, a woman ascetic named Bharaj Mohini Didi. Traveling without money or baggage, the two led the life of wandering pilgrims, blessing everyone they met with their joyful and uplifting presence. Can you imagine meeting Ma on the street or someplace just traveling as anybody else might? At other times, Ma would be surrounded by throngs of devotees who stayed with her day and night and receiving her guidance and expressing their love and devotion in different ways. There would be days when Ma would remain sitting in one place for 14 or 15 hours at a stretch, greeting the influx of visitors with the same blissful and loving smile, showing no signs of fatigue. Close devotees who tried unsuccessfully to manage the influx of people and allow Ma to rest for some time asked her if the constant push of the crowd bothered her. She replied, "Are you annoyed if your own hand touches your leg or another part of your body? To me, there is only one, and all are his manifestations. You and I are one, and the space between us is also myself." There are innumerable incidents of Ma being drawn to a particular place by the sincere call of a devotee's heart. One old and infirm sadhu in the coastal city of Puri had been longing for Ma's darshan, but because of his age and infirmity was unable to make the journey, and so only prayed to her in his heart. Ma, who was far away at the time, suddenly changed her plans and made an unexpected trip to Puri. One day, to the sadhu's surprise, she simply walked into his room and sat next to his bed and spoke with him for a long time. Another time, Ma was seated at a religious function when she suddenly got up and left the gathering, followed by Didi and one or two other devotees. She went directly to the railroad station and boarded a waiting train. Getting down at a small station where the train usually did not stop, and followed by her bewildered companion, she walked briskly through the town to a small rest house for pilgrims. She went directly towards one room without asking questions and entered inside. There was a woman sitting on a bed and weeping inconsolably. Ma simply said, "Don't weep. See, I have come." The surprised woman's tears turned into one of joy and gratitude. Upon composing herself, she told Didi that she had come to this small town on receiving information that Ma would be there, but on finding that Ma was somewhere far away, had retired to a lonely room where she tearfully poured forth her grief and longing for Ma. Time and space were non-existent for Ma, and she always responded to the true longing of the heart. Ma has said, "Your sorrow, your pain, your agony is indeed my sorrow. The body understands everything." Ma would frequently refer to herself as this body, having no feeling of herself as a separate entity from God. One of the hallmarks we see in all the great masters is this supreme love. Supreme love for first God, and then the other one like it, for all humanity, for they see all beings as expressions of themselves, as divine manifestations. Let us not rest until we have been granted this beautiful vision, not just for a moment, but that it becomes our continuous way of being in this world. There is so much richness, there is so much to be added to life. We oftentimes, because the ego projects upon God realization its own nature, we see God realization as somehow limiting us. Isn't that a wonderful lie of the ego? That he sees God realization as something less than what the ego has. It's really amazing when you think about it, and yet someplace deep down inside of us, we feel that way, or we wouldn't wait a moment to go running to our infinite Lord. Be inspired from day to day, moment to moment. Let your heart always run as a river runs towards the ocean, towards that infinite state of being. One difference between the ego self and the God self, the true self. The ego self is always full of self-interest. Self-interest is what satisfies the little self, the body, the senses. The God self, or the true self, with a capital S, has self-interest and is always interested in how to serve. How can I bring joy to another person's life? How can I bring more light into this world? How can I serve? And so when you look at your life, look at it with an analytical light, point of view. Are you living to serve? Or are you living to satisfy the ego nature only? A life of service brings with it real freedom, real joy. It leaves anxiety behind you, because now you are no longer living in fear. You are simply attuning yourself to the divine mind and acting as God would have you act, without any need or knowledge beyond this, that you are God's very own. And you have been, and you forever will be. What more does any devotee need to know than this? So let us, as Babaji would say, Dara Danda Utau, let us lift our camp and our staff. Let us make our journey. Not be satisfied with what we have, but dive ever deeper into the infinite ocean. May you be blessed in your journey now and always. And forever whisper in your heart of hearts, O my beloved, my infinite beloved. Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my being.
Surging in every cell of my being.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
January 31st, and it's the anniversary of Mother's Maha Samadhi, the leaving of her body. We will plan at 4:30 in the afternoon to meet out at the place where Mother is buried. If you need directions to that place, Carla can give them to you. And that if you are not able to come there, that at 4:30 on the 31st, if you can just join us in silence, in remembrance, in attunement with Mother, with not only the life that she lived it, but who she is now. For she is a powerful, powerful spiritual presence. And through your attunement with her, you will feel her. You will be uplifted by the power of God within her. Has the power to transform your life. So that will be at 4:30 on Thursday afternoon, that's coming on the 31st.